You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the first Times Higher Education issue review podcast of 2016. We'll be covering the 7th to the 13th of January edition. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Ellie Bothwell, Chris Havergal and Matthew Rice. Having suffered restrictions and reductions in funding, does a change of government in Canada mean the dark days are over for the nation's scientists? Ellie Bothwell's cover feature looks into that in some detail this week. She'll have an overview for us very shortly. Has the creation of research partnerships in UK higher education helped more prestigious universities to gobble up more research funding at the expense of newer institutions? That's the topic of Chris Havergal's lead news story this week. And finally, Joanna Williams has been an outspoken critic of higher education for many years. Matthew has been speaking to her about her new book, Academic Freedom in the Age of Conformity, and he'll give us an overview of his discussion very soon too. But first, to Canada, Ellie. The cover feature this week looks at, well, the state of Canada, its higher education system in the era, well, a new era and a new government.
Yes, that's right. It's looking at kind of what the impact will be of the new Liberal Party. Obviously, you know, during the Conservative government over the last decade, scientists have been very concerned about cuts in funding, about the lack of transparency around research and the fact that they kind of, in a lot of cases, government scientists weren't able to speak to the media freely. And so the kind of question really is whether this is going to be the kind of new era that's been promised. I mean, it seems that, you know, the Liberal Party, on the face of it, are very pro-science. They were sort of elected partly on the basis of their science policies, and they've already got kind of three ministers with a kind of science agenda.
Yeah, there was a picture that went quite viral of Justin Trudeau's new cabinet, if you will, new senior ministers. A great spread of experts on a number of areas, a good gender balance as well. It was attracting a lot of praise.
Yeah. He committed for a 50-50 gender split, and he delivered on that. The new sort of science minister, Kirsty Duncan, is a scientist. And it's been it's been restored to a cabinet level position as well, because it was sort of that role was changed in the previous government. So you know, on the face of it, you know, he's doing all the right things. They've also restored the mandatory long form census, which is a big concern of academics. So it seems like he's moving in the right direction, but the sort of question really is there hasn't been any commitment so far about actual science funding. These are kind of seen as easy wins, really, for him. So it'll kind of be whether he's actually going to move further on this.
Yeah, I mean, can I ask? I mean, some of the stuff that you've covered in the feature, I mean, not just the spending cuts, but also sort of, you know, restrictions on scientists speaking to the media. It sounds pretty serious stuff. Did you get a sense when you were writing this, sort of about, clearly academics were concerned about this, but was there wider public concern about the way the last government was handling universities and science?
Yeah, definitely. There was a big sort of public uproar really about it all, and there were protests where it wasn't just scientists that had attended. It was people saying that it moved further than science. It was saying that, you know, this was the Conservative government was one that didn't believe in kind of evidence-based policy, and therefore they didn't really believe in truth and they didn't believe in democracy. That was their argument. So it was definitely a sort of wider campaign than just from the scientists.
Yeah, I mean, there's a timeline in your piece of the Harper government's war on science, as it's termed. I guess coming out of that era, is there a risk that a lot of these positive signs are just honeymoon period type stuff, and that, you know, obviously after that you're always going to have praise for any changes? Do you think there'll be long-lasting change? Do you get a sense that these commitments that you say are missing will be forthcoming?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say, obviously. I mean, I think if you kind of listen to what the Liberal Party say, then you know, if you believe what they said, then they've got a commitment there. I mean, part of the problem in terms of higher education is that's actually a provincial responsibility. So although they can change things in terms of science, it differs a lot in each area. You know, the sort of tuition fees vary hugely. So I don't know in terms of higher education specifically how much will change. Kind of academics at universities might not see as much impact as kind of government scientists. But I mean, I think that there is definitely a sense that the people are optimistic, but they are still wary and that the honeymoon period isn't going to be very long for the Liberal Party.
Well, from page 36 in the magazine, you can read that feature, or of course online at timeshighereducation.com. It does include some very informative graphics as well. If you're not too familiar with the Canadian HE system, there's some very good information there too. Moving on though, and back to the UK, to our lead news story this week, Chris. Research consortiums. We know, I can name a few of them, the Eastern Arc, N8, these sort of groups of universities that have come together, ostensibly, my understanding, to sort of share resources and and work, you know, a little bit more closely together for the good for the good of HE. You've been looking into what the implications of some of this joint working are for universities, perhaps on the outside.
Yeah, certainly this is the first major study of its type looking at the formation of research consortia. You're right to say initially these were very much on a regional basis and about sharing resources, but you've got to look at the types of institutions which are in these groupings. The paper, which is by three researchers at the Loughborough University, calculates that 18 out of 21 long-standing members of the Russell Group are members of an alliance, and only 6 out of 14 members of the former 1994 group are. The University Alliance and Million Plus, who represent newer universities, don't have any representation at all. So while it might be good to share resources, the fact is that the government is looking to allocate funding for research projects to projects which are collaborative, which are better managed, because they see it as a way of getting better value for money. Another factor here is that clearly some of these universities are responding to what's termed the Golden Triangle, which is the universities of Oxford and Cambridge and some of the leading London universities, which are clearly taking a ever-increasing proportion of research funding. The issue is, if you put those two things together, government looking to reward collaborative research and the Golden Triangle taking a bigger chunk, that means that if you're not part of these regional alliances, which these newer universities aren't, there's an ever-decreasing pot of funding available for you. The paper says a metaphorical drawbridge is being pulled up behind the larger research-intensive universities, and an ever-decreasing number of universities are able to compete at the top table in UK higher education.
Well, I mean, I suppose the question is, what do you do about it? I mean, you can't stop universities forming these groups with other institutions unless you become sort of a teacher in a primary school classroom and force universities to work with the institutions that they perhaps wouldn't have chosen to in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, it's a difficult one because, clearly this is one take on the what's happening in regional higher education. The other argument is that actually some of these trends, the concentration of research funding, have been happening anyway over many years. I think the problem that these new institutions face is that it doesn't seem quite as simple for them to say, oh, well, we'll just either set up our own regional alliance or we'll just try to join in, because it appears that some of these leading institutions really don't want to let some of these newer institutions in because of the perceived prestige of these alliances.
Interesting stuff. Well, that study's in our news section on the website, on page 6, if you subscribe to the magazine. Some of the news stories in our news section this week include the latest update on Russell Group Vice Chancellor's pay. You can also read about former Shadow Chancellor Ed Ball's views on the £9,000 fees system. And also we've got an infographic showing the gender breakdown at course level for different subjects in UK universities. They're all online too, of course. But Matthew, back to our features section again. Our second feature this week is an interview with Joanna Williams, who, academic title is Director of the Master's Programme in Higher Education at the University of Kent, but she's probably well known on certainly on Twitter and certainly in our pages as an outspoken critic of higher education. You've been catching up with her about her latest book.
Yes, I mean, her earlier book, which is called Consuming Higher Education, was a sort of discuss, an attack on the sort of marketized student as consumer model of higher education, and was broadly welcomed by the sector, I think. Her new book is about academic freedom And she believes that universities have become very, very conformist places, and that often there's less freedom of speech, at least in some areas, than there is, you know, in the average pub, that the things that just can't be talked about. And she it's manifestly true that, you know, calls for censorship and so on have in the past have often come from, you know, church authorities or McCarthyism and so on, from the right of the political spectrum. She believes that a lot of the main dangers now come from the left, and indeed from within the academy. And so she, you know, one of the book is essentially call, you know, one of the things it's calling for is much more freedom and much more willingness to discuss ideas which are painful and disturbing and even offensive, among our other grounds, on the grounds that you know, if people say things which are very inflammatory and offensive, they can be rebutted and contested, you know, at the same time and in the same meeting.
It must be quite tricky, mustn't it, working in a sector that you are writing so critically about. Did she talk at all about, you know, whether she wants to stay in academia, whether the you know, whether, if you're so sort of, if you're so, what's the word, disenfranchised, I guess, by the area in which you were, you know, why do you stay there?
Well, I think this is interesting. I mean, she is retreating from the academy, as it were. She's going to be working, you know, much, I think, basically one day a week rather than full time, precisely because she wants to pursue the discussion of, you know, more controversial ideas, which she thinks is difficult within the academy. So she's putting her money where her mouth is, in that sense, if you like.
Interesting stuff. Well, you can read that very insightful interview with Joanna Williams from page 42 in the magazine, of course, online too. There's also a blog which Matthew has written about that interview, which you'll find on our blog section. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you wish to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything in the magazine or on our website, then please visit us at timeshighereducation.com. You'll find us on Twitter at timeshighered, and you can also search for us on LinkedIn and Facebook. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.